Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 224, and we are now in verse 8 of chapter 13 of Exodus, where we read, "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, It is because of that which the Lord did for me when I came forth out of Egypt." Now this statement became a hallmark statement in the house of Judah. And to this very day in the community, whenever they come to the Passover and they recite all these segments of all the writings and statements here about the Passover, where God commanded them to do all these things on the night to be remembered, which is also the Passover, the same night. There's no separation between these two. And has never been from the days of Egypt, only in the minds of those, you know, in modern times that had no knowledge nor understanding of that. In either case, this is a statement that they all make right here, that God had done it to me. In other words, they don't say, well, once upon a time, long, long time ago, our forefathers, you see, came out of Egypt. No Jew ever says that. They always say, I came out of Egypt, and God has done that to me. And that's in essence what the rabbis admonished all the people to do in the Jewish community. So they would not regard it as an incident that happened a long time ago, totally unrelated to their own lives, and doesn't really have any personal meaning. But they wanted them to feel that they are a part of it, as a continuation, and it's as if they themselves came out of it, and therefore, with that in mind, to serve God and to worship God and to honor God and to remember all of His good deeds. And so they generally use this terminology in many other things. You know, they don't say Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You see, that seems to be removed. They say our father Abraham, you see, our father Isaac and Jacob, or our mother Sarah. You know, it's a personal thing. And people that don't do it, they create a distance between them and the events and the reality of it and the God that was behind it. And so that's in essence what they're doing here. And on the Passover night, literally, this is a part of what they call the Haggadah, that is the telling reciting. And ironically, that's the very name of the Quran. Quran, that's what it means. You know, the book of Islam means the recital. In other words, you recite. And the Haggadah basically means the same, to tell or to recite. And so, you shall recite or you shall tell your son in that day. You see, you yourself, on a personal basis, pass on the information from generation to generation. And until modern times, education was basically the domain of the father, of the parent. You see, from God's point of view, just like in his case, he made the baby, he is going to educate him. Just like God created us, he is going to educate us. He doesn't assign us to the holy angels to be educated. He himself does it on a personal basis, the personally or through his word, through inspiration. And so he commanded the parents, and unfortunately as time went by and society developed into something else, and they came out of the land, you know, that had forsaken the land or booted out of the land or whatever it may be, and now a new society was being created, and complexities of life became a reality, and therefore the parents had to go to work. They could not be around to teach their children, and besides, you know, technology took over as time went by, and parents couldn't do much about it anyway. And so, you have now the educational system, and we take it for granted. That's the way it is. That's the way it's supposed to be. What we don't realize, as it was in the past, it shall be also in the future. There will be no educational system, an artificial educational, which is actually an informational system with all the iniquities that are in it. People will be in the land, farmers, shepherds. Parents will teach their children the ways of God and the ways of life. You see? Well, most children today know nothing about the ways of life. They grow into adulthood and still they're babes in their 20s and 30s and have no experience in life. That's because of the breakdown of this system and the invention of man's system, replacing God's educational system that was directly from the parents to the children and from the priesthood to the parents. And all that was for free. That's why, you know, the way it is today. Try to put your kid, you know, through school from the beginning of life until the end of life. You spend, a lot of people spend a good $200,000 per person. And that's a horrible crime. Anyway, God says you do it personally. You pass it on as a personal experience. And you tell your son, you came out of Egypt, you've been delivered by God. And God had done those things for you. Not long, long time ago. Well, there's no relationship there. You see? And they kept that for many, many centuries, thousands of years, that spirit, that attitude, and to this very day they continue, at least in the Passover service and many other occasions. And so he said, you tell your son that this is because of what God had done for me when I came. You see, not when my forefathers came, but when I came out of Egypt. And we can, in essence, sympathize with that, or understand that and comprehend that today, because we have had our own personal experiences of coming out of Egypt, so we should be able to do likewise with our own kids when the Passover time comes, you know, the night to be remembered, and explain to the children, why are we doing what we are doing, you know, instead of that false doctrine that was in a certain organization that we used to be a part of, where they basically booted out the children away, contrary to the will and the teachings of God, from the Passover service. They said it's only for adults. Nowhere in the Bible do you ever see that teaching. On the contrary, you see just the opposite. The whole family did partake in that, and it is through this process that God was passing on also His truth from generation to generation. You know, so what did we do? You know, we thought we were smarter than God, and we threw away, you know, the kids in essence, and so they began to think, well, this is my dad's religion, not mine. And that's exactly what God was trying to prevent here. So a kid wouldn't say that's my dad's religion, or, you know, a long time ago it happened. That this it happened to my dad, and then when he grows older, the kid will say that to his own son. This is what happened to me. And this is what God is saying here from the beginning. And so this became a part of the later on developed full order of the Haggadah, you know, that special evening and everything that they are saying during that evening, and it is still kept to this very day. And basically the Haggadah that you have today that has few modern additions in terms of many centuries ago, and presently a lot of people are writing their own Haggadah, and, you know, the feminists do writing their own Haggadah, the liberal, you know, Jews write their own Haggadah, and so forth and so forth, injecting their own personal things there. But the basic Haggadah that has been in the Jewish community until recent time was basically from the days of much of it was from the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, and many parts of it went to, you know, all the way back to Elijah, and other parts of it, six of it, began right here, as they came out of Egypt 3,500 years ago. And so God said, verse 9, it shall be for a sign unto you upon your hand, you see, and a sign generally could be either a divine sign or a sign that God gives His people. The Sabbath, for example, is a sign. You see, it's not a sign that you see. It's not a sign like, you know, you hang on a door or on a store, you know, to show you what company it is. But it's a spiritual sign. And when you come to it and you do all those things that you do for the Sabbath, preparing for the Sabbath on Friday and going through the motions of the Sabbath, rejoicing, delighting yourself, studying the law, walking with God, praying, you know, and all those things, the whole thing becomes a sign that you are the people of God. That God is your God, you see, and that you are His people. And so he's talking about these signs here. And it shall be for a sign unto you upon your hand, and for a memorial, or zikaron, that means something that you engrave, as we mentioned earlier, the difference between male and female, and why in the Hebrew they say zachar and nekeva, zachar, zikaron, because of what you engrave in your mind. And it should be between your eyes. Now, between your eyes is basically what your mind is. That the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. And as time went by, the rabbis studied this thing and then thought, well, let's make it something more visible. You know, people always like to have things more visible, you know, including gods. And so they created God in their own image and likeness. And here they came up with this idea. And it developed gradually. We don't know how it began exactly. But it began to what is called today, or in the past many centuries, the tefillin, and tefillin means the plural of tefillah, which means a prayer. And so when they put those things, and some of you have seen those, you know, how the Jews put it on their right hand, you know, they tie it around, and they put one in on their forehead, and they do it in the morning, every morning, not on Sabbath, not on holidays, and not at night, but every morning. And that basically is, for them physically, symbolically, is what it means. And in that box that they have over their head, you know, they basically, and they have one on their arm, which they tie around, they put portions of the law that talk about the unity of God, about the kingdom of God, about, you know, the laws of God. And so, in essence, they affirm their faith in the laws of God, in the truth of God. Of course, they call it Judaism. That's a later terminology. But the reality is that God, when he gave it, he's not talking about those things that came later on, that the rabbis, you know, down the road came up with. Moses didn't come up with that. The prophets didn't come up with that. You don't see anywhere in the Bible ever, anybody ever mentioning anything like that. You know, that didn't come until Rabbinic Judaism basically looked at that and said, well, let's make it a little bit more visible and more material, and so you can see and touch and handle and do it with your own, you know, hands. And so with that in mind, that's how we're going to keep the law. But in essence, what God was saying, you know, whatever you do with your hand, you see, so you put it as a sign on your hand, that's what he's saying. Everything you're going to do with your hands, basically most things in life that we do with our hands, has to be with that in mind, that we are the servants of God, that he is our God. And we're not going to make idols with our own hands. We're not going to bow down and raise our hands, you know, to an idol. We're not going to do mischief and evil, you see, with our hands. And then you put it between your eyes, that means also in your mind. So it's a sign on your hand. So it's a spiritual sign. It's not a physical one, as the Jews made it. And to begin with, it's not on the hand that they do it. You know, they just tie a little bit on the hand, but most of it is on the arm. And that's not what God said. He didn't say on your arms. He said on your hand. And then he said, you know, between your eyes, the memorial. Now, that's something that you remember, you see. It's not something that you put up there, you know, as a gadget, you know, you put up there. But it's a sign, you put it between your eyes, and that's where your mind is. In other words, engrave it. That's what the zikaron means, the memorial. Engrave it between your eyes. Write it, in essence, on the table of your hearts. That's a part of the circumcision, you see, the spiritual circumcision, which certainly they haven't done, generally speaking. You know, very few here and there in between. But the majority of them, even if they go through this physical ceremony, doing it every morning, and I did it when I was a kid, growing up in the synagogue. But, you know, it's just a ritual that you go through and doesn't mean anything to, you know, just, you just do it. You know, like everybody else, like we all do in religion, you know. My dad taught me and I do it and that's it. This is not what God meant. What he meant is everything that you do with your hand and everything that comes out of your mind, out of your heart, must be in remembrance of the Torah of God. And that's what he said. It shall be for a sign unto you upon your hand, and for a memorial between your eyes, that the Torah, see, that's the purpose of it. And if you put it on, you know, on you, as a lot of people do, and there's some in our midst also, to one degree or the other, you know, they join the synagogue, and then they put those things on, and, you know, because they think, well, that's the way it should be. Well, you know, if you use it to remind you of those things, it's one thing. God didn't say don't do it, but on the other hand, it's, you know, what he commanded. And to begin with, it's meaningless if the reality is not behind it. And the reality is, we do all that so that we may remember the Torah of God. Walk in it, obey it, revel in it, feed on it, you know, drink of it. That's how we eat and drink the flesh of Jesus Christ, the God of Israel, who gave these laws, who is speaking here through Moses. And that's in essence what God says to Moses, to tell Israel. And so he says, you do that so that the Torah of God, the law of God, the Lord, may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand has the Eternal, or the Lord, or Jehovah, brought you out of Egypt. So that was the intent that God had in mind. Not just a physical, meaningless ceremony. Now, it could be meaningful if you really, as you do that, you know, it's not that God commanded us. God didn't command us. The rabbis are the ones that came up with it, you know, with good intention. Nothing wrong about it. God allows us to do a lot of, you know, physical things on our own for good intentions. You know, a lot of people are hanging the Ten Commandments on the wall. God didn't command that. There's nothing wrong with that, you see. So we should not make fun of that just because the Jews do it and we don't. You see, we do other things. The intention was there to serve God. And for those who really literally do it with that in mind, I think it's pleasing in the sight of God. I don't see anything wrong with that. But on the other hand, let's realize that this is not what necessarily what God said in this command. So we don't do it. It doesn't mean that we're disobedient to God just because the Jews do it. You know, it didn't come from Moses. It came from Rabbinic Judaism. And it was, you know, the right intention of the part of the rabbis to teach people to, because, you know, people are carnal, they need things to do and think and see and things like that. So that's the reason why they came up with that. Totally for good intentions, there is nothing wrong with that. That's within the law, and God allows us many things within the law to do that He did not necessarily personally command. He doesn't have to tell us every tiny little thing, but, you know, if we need reminders, as many of us do, that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. And a lot of people put scriptures right in front of them on the desk. There's nothing wrong with that. God didn't command that. What God did, you know, let the law of God be constantly before your eyes. So if that's the way you do it, fine. There's no problem with that. See, the problem is when people begin to take this and that and the other thing and make it the law and then clobber others with it and then, you know, make themselves superior in the sight of others and abase others and so forth. You know, I'm better than you are. I'm holier than you are. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. Like the Pharisee would say, I'm fasting twice a day. I give tithe of cumin and this and that and the other thing. And Christ said, okay, you know, just like with the man that came and did that in the temple, or like the Pharisees that he upbraided in Matthew 23. He says, you know, you tithe of the cumin and the mint and all that. You go through all those details. He didn't say that's terrible, that's wrong, you shouldn't do that. He said, you forgot the major aspects of the law. So, do the major aspects of the law, justice and judgment, you know, and faith and mercy and all those things, and don't leave the others, those little things that you do, undone. You see, and some people forget that. And they think, oh, I just have to do the big thing and forget about the little ones. God is not interested in that attitude either. You don't go from one extreme to the other. You know, some people say, well, I'm just going to keep the Ten Commandments and forget about all the rest. Well, when Uzzah, you know, they forgot about, you know, tiny little one, you know, God killed him for it. When the sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, or Nadab and Abihu in English, forgot about, you know, that little law that God said, you know, don't bring any foreign fire to my temple. You see, a tiny little law. Well, God got rid of them. He zapped them on the spot. So let's not ever mock God, you know, in big laws or little laws. That's what Jesus Christ made it very plain. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but not one jot or one tittle from the Torah. See, we should never have that attitude. And there is a false doctrine that you hear it all the time. That many of us are guilty of to one degree or the other. We are saying it here and there, and not because God said that, you see. We don't see it anywhere in the Bible. Oh, that's necessary. It's not necessary for salvation. The Protestants, Protestants would say it's not salvific. Everybody invents, you know, their own terminology. What do we mean it's not necessary for salvation? What Uzzah didn't do, was it not necessary for salvation? His life was at stake and he lost it. You see, a lot of people are playing games with the law of God and they determine in their own mind, being lawgivers in their own sight, what is necessary for salvation and what is not. We're kidding ourselves and we're kidding, you know, everybody else when we teach this kind of lies. And that's all it is, just absolute lies. They don't come from the mind of God. And they did not proceed from His law. Imagine if Jesus Christ had that attitude. Oh, well, I don't need to do that. You know, that's not necessary for salvation. And I don't need to do this. And I can break this law. And that way, it's just a little one, you know, big deal, you know. He wouldn't be a lamb without spot and blemish, would he? Are we going to be a lamb without spot and blemish if that's the attitude we continue with? You know, let's sit down and think hard about what we're saying, what comes out of our mouth. Because by every word that comes out of our mouth, we're going to be judged. And that's what he said. Anybody. He made it very plain, Matthew, you know, 5:17-19. Anybody who does not do this law, all the law, the big and the little, the jots and the tittles, and teaches others, you see, anybody who doesn't do that and teaches others, he's not going to be in the kingdom. Yeah, you begin with a little sin, it becomes a bigger one, and pretty soon, you are like the devil. That's how it began. What a little thing. Oh, well, it's not necessary for salvation. God wouldn't mind. We can make an alteration here. And imagine if Moses had done the same. God gives him instructions and he alters here and there. He makes changes here and there. He gives him, you know, instructions in detail, specific about the tabernacle. And he says, well, I don't know. I don't think red is looks good. I'm going to try purple or whatever, or green. You see, you don't function like that with God. Many of us have developed this attitude, and we're so comfortable with it to the point that we feel comfortable about saying, well, this is not, you know, necessary for salvation. Who told us that? God or the devil? And then when God, you know, gives instructions, he gives them in details, and we don't play games with him. You see, we follow him, and exactly what he says. Every jot, every tittle is extremely important in his sight. Now, obviously, you know, we shouldn't be so picky about the little ones and forget about the big ones. But on the other hand, we should not just be big-minded only by the big ones and say, well, the little ones are picky. Because God gave them both. That's what counts. That's the criteria to what we obey. If God gave that law, big or little, we don't say about any one of them, it's not necessary for salvation. And that's to our shame, many of us who are doing it and saying it, so casually, and they feel so smug and uncomfortable, you know, and all that. We should never do that. We may not understand certain little ones, that's one thing, but we should never have this attitude, because that's the attitude of all the rebels, you know, that God destroyed many times, you know, for little things, not only for big things. Now, Uzzah is an example. Sons of Aaron are an example. God was not a respecter of persons, and many others were examples. And you can see the law. Many things that are not the major ones, God says, you do those things or you don't, I'll cut you off. That's all there is to it. No spot, no blemish in our garments of righteousness are allowed into the kingdom. Once we get it through, you know, through our thick head, you know, we don't play games with the law of God anymore after that. You see? We need to learn to fear God all the way, not just partially. And so that's what he's teaching them meticulously. With every tiny little statement that he gives them, every word. There are no suggestions here. And so he says, you repeat that to your child, you know. Just like you talk to a little kid. Every tiny little thing, you got to tell them. And that's the way God dealt with us also as his little children. Every little thing that we needed in life, he told us. And we cannot say, well, I don't want to do that. Or that, you know, this is not important to me. That's not necessary for salvation, you see. Those kind of people obviously are not interested in a full relationship with God, only a partial one. And so, this is what he says to them. You do it for a sign on your hand. Everything that you do, you know, as Paul said, whatever, not few things, not some things, whatever you do in word or in deed, word out of your mind, deed out of your hand, do it as unto the Lord. And you don't come unto the Lord and say, well, those laws are not important to me because they're not necessary for salvation and I have determined that. What are you going to do about that? You see, we just don't act like that. And so he said, you do those things. Why? So that the Torah. What does the Torah include? The big and the little. You see, the major aspects of it and the jot and the tittle. And so that was in essence what the rabbis who unfortunately went from one extreme to the other, have done, when they said to the Jews, you know, let's begin doing, you know, doing these kind of things, and then that became a reality, and then people thought, well, that went all the way to Moses. But their intention was good. We're not going to allow any tiny little detail escape our attention in our obedience to God. You see, so the intention was good, and I'm sure it was pleased, you know, pleasing in the sight of God. There's nothing wrong with that. The only problem with that is if you just do it on a ritual basis, but really your word, your hand is still doing evil and your mind is still spewing wickedness. And that's unfortunately the case of most who are putting those things on, and only the few are really the genuine, spiritual, and the Jews whose hearts are circumcised. And all of us have to learn lessons from this. And then we read in verse 10, you shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And it shall be, when the Lord shall bring you into the land of the Canaanite, as he swore unto you, you know, it's the land of the Canaanites, not the land of Palestine, as he swore unto you, and some people say, well, it doesn't make any difference, it's not necessary for salvation, you know, whether I call it Israel, or land of Canaan, or land of Israel, or Palestine. It is. It's important to God. If it offends him, you see, we better be careful. As he swore unto you and to your fathers, and shall give it to you, not to somebody else, that you shall set apart unto the Lord all that opens the womb, every firstling that is a male, you know, be it a human being or an animal, which you have coming off a beast, all that shall be the Lord's. And every firstling of an ass you shall redeem with a lamb. And God is not interested in donkeys, obviously. You know, he can't do anything with it in the temple or the tabernacle, so you have to redeem it. You know, if it is a donkey or a horse or a mule, well, you have to redeem it with a lamb. And if you will not redeem it, he says, then you shall break its neck. It was so horrible, especially, you know, the animal movement. You know, they say, well, what kind of a horrible law is that? Well, in essence, God was telling them, look, you want to keep your donkey, you give me a lamb instead, because I don't want a donkey. It's an unclean animal. But if you're so selfish, you don't want to give me the donkey, you see, and you're not willing to give me the lamb instead of it, I want you to break its neck. Well, obviously the Israelites would say, I don't want to do that. So what is he going to do? He's going to obey the law. But that's obedience through grudging spirit, which is not good. So in essence, you have to understand, it's not that the people did break the neck of the donkeys, they didn't. Probably never, ever, nobody ever has ever done that. You know, what do you gain by that? You break the neck of the donkey, you know, you'd rather give a lamb. And so, in other words, he was just impressing it on their minds. Don't compromise with any tiny little law that I give you. It's a big one or little one. Otherwise, you're breaking my law. You see? And when you do, might as well break the neck, you know, of the donkey or the horse or the mule, and since you're not going to do it, so be obedient. And preferably do it from your heart and not grudgingly. And so he says, if you don't redeem it, you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of men among your sons shall you redeem. And that's what they do. They do, you know. You know, the redemption ceremony, they call it the Pidyon in Hebrew, the redemption. They literally go through the ceremony. Every baby, every son in the Jewish community goes through the ceremony. That is, you know, obviously we're talking about the religious community. The non-religious, which are the majority nowadays, don't care about it, but up to recent times, all of the Jews were religious, so every single one of them had done it. And you give the coin, you know, the seat on a seat, they call it the seat of Elijah, and they have the godfather, you know, that's where the godfather concept came from in the Catholic way, you know, religion. It came from this Jewish custom, which came from the Bible. You know, it was known as a Jewish custom, but actually it's biblical, from Moses, from Israel. And then they came up with this idea also, you know, as they went into the world, you know, the world learned about it, and they began to copy that, and they had developed this concept of the Godfather. This is where it came, from this very teaching here. And so he says, you shall redeem them, and it shall be when your son asks you, not asks the tales, but you. So you are the parent, you are the educator. When he asks you, in time to come, saying, what is this? See, if you kick him out of the Passover ceremony and he's not there, it's only for adults, how is he going to ask you? How is he going to learn? How is he going to know what is it that God commanded? You see? But, you know, people, the sincere people, but misguided, having the knowledge, you know, the zeal of God, but not according to knowledge, invented that, unfortunately, and people followed it. In the process, many of the youth were lost. You see? You cannot disobey the law of God and produce good out of it. You know, you produce evil, and that's exactly what was the result. And people didn't learn, still don't learn to this very day. And they continue, a lot of people still do the same to this very day. In their ignorance, not in their knowledge. You know, in spite of their sincerity, you know, the results are not good. And so it says, you should, you know, when your son, you know, when he's around, involved in that ceremony, and there has never been any separation there in the family, especially not at Passover, where there ought to be unity. He says, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? Say, what do you wash your feet for? What do you drink the wine? What do you eat in bed? You know, whatever, all kind of things like that. And then you tell him, you shall say to him, by strength of hand, the Eternal brought us out, us, you see, in every generation, that's the terminology they use to this very day. God brought us, not our forefathers, but us, out from Egypt, from the house of bondage. You know, we were in bondage to sin. God brought us up. Out of that, you see, he didn't bring, you know, our forefathers, us, every single one of us on an every generational basis. We must see it that way because it is this way. And so it came to pass when Pharaoh, he says, would hardly let us go, that the Lord slew all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. Now that's, of course, that's not something that happens every day, but the reality is, in order for God to deliver us from bondage to sin, you see, that's in essence what he does. He helps us basically burn the bridges behind, you know, with those people that lead us to sin, to darkness. You know, we don't hang around anymore with people that go to the bar all the time and drink and get drunk and curse and use foul language and do all kind of other lewd things, you see. You know, so, you know, in the same manner as if God is slaying the firstborn of Egypt, the firstborn of the wicked world in which we are, all those that are leading us to sin, to bondage. So that still goes on and on a daily basis in our lives. And so, basically, you know, we can add those things in this ceremony that we should have, you know, on the night of the Passover, the night to be remembered, which are the same night. There's no separation between the two. And teach our children what it is all about. So they are, they are trained from a very young age, and their mind is made up in that direction, and they are programmed in this way. And they grow older, and they do not forsake the faith, and becomes their faith from the beginning of life, and not the faith of my dad. You know, it's not my dad's religion. You don't see a Jewish kid, you know, in the Orthodox community or religious community ever thinking that or saying that this is my dad's religion. That never occurs. You know, to never occur to any one of us who have been raised in this way of life. You know, it never occurred to me to think that way. And when we do it the proper way according to the instructions of God, then it doesn't occur. You see, but if we disobey the laws of God and say, oh, well, you know, these are little laws, we don't need to do it, it's not that important, it's not necessary for salvation, and so forth, well, we end up with the sorry results. Our children are not with us. And so he said, you know, because of that, God slew the firstborn of Egypt, all the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord all that opens the womb, being males, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. And the Jewish community, they can say to this very day, you know, we departed from that. We think, well, that's not necessary for us. You know, that's Jewish stuff. That's the law. That's Judaizing. And so forth, and we're going to come before Jesus Christ, and he's going to ask us, have you done that? What are we going to say? Well, no, we didn't think that was necessary for salvation. You know, we just believe in you, love you, and you know, we are under grace, and forget about the rest. I think we're going to be surprised when that time comes, and I don't think it's a good idea to wait for that moment for that to happen. Verse 16, and it shall be for a sign, he said, upon your hand, and for frontlets between your eyes. So he's repeating that again. That you do those things, you see, and you remember to say those things, and you pass it on to your children. And so this is the second repetition of the first one, of how the religion of God, the ways of God, the path of God, the truth of God ought to be passed on and enacted, you see, physically and spiritually all the time. And that's in essence why he's repeating that. And of course the rabbis, you know, saw it several times there, and they thought, well, I guess this is what he means. And never dawned on them, well, if Moses didn't do it, the prophets didn't do it, why are we doing it? And thinking that that's what he meant. If this is what he meant, you know, they would have done it then, long time ago. But, you know, their intent was right, their sincerity was right there, so there's nothing wrong with that. If they want to do it, God allows us many things that we want to do. He doesn't dictate every tiny little detail. And as long as it's not contrary to his law, there is nothing wrong with that. So, you know, that's the reason why we have to understand. You can live with many people and disagree with what they do, but not be disagreeable. And understand, as Paul said, well, do you have faith in that? Fine. You know, do it according to your faith. Let it be according to your faith. I'm not going to gainsay that or speak evil of that or put you down for it. And unfortunately, we've been taught to be so dogmatic in every tiny little point, you know, in a Pharisaic manner, in the wrong way, you know, the wrong kind of zeal, that we begin to criticize everybody who's not exactly like us. And so even among the churches of God, the people of God, they all criticize each other because they're doing things differently. And that's not wise. This is not God's way. God allows variations there and things that are not contrary to the law for us to do. And he allowed his people even to do things that were not in accordance with the law, but, you know, he didn't see anything wrong with that. Hezekiah, you know, wanted to have the Passover feast one more week. And God said, it's okay. It's not something you want to do every single year, but that was a special occasion. You see, God allows a lot of those exceptions or leeways or, you know, little differences here and there as long as they are within the law of God. So you can either be like Jesus Christ, you eat and drink, you see, Or you can be like John the Baptist, who was very strict and more ascetic in his lifestyle, and still be within the law. And yet people were making fun of both of them. The one they call Wine Bieber, and the other one they say has got a demon in him. And Christ, you know, condemned this kind of an attitude that isn't in the heart of man. And so let's understand that also. And so this is what God is saying. Verse 16 again, and it shall be for a sign upon your hand and for frontlets between your eyes. You know, it's got to be written in your heart. That's what he's saying here in your, you know, your mind. That's where your mind is, between your eyes. For by strength of hand, of the hand of the Lord, not of men, not of the general Moses, but of the shepherd Moses, you know, with a piece of wood, you know, the rod, with not a spear, with not a sword, and with that God delivered Israel. You know, this is just symbolic, obviously, the rod, and all the signs and miracles that were performed by it. It's God who is doing it. But, you know, people need physical things because we're human beings, and God understands that. And so he is commanding us to do an awful lot of physical things too. Being physical, we need them. You see, nothing wrong with them, as long as they do not alter the intent of the law of God, the physical and the spiritual. It's okay with God. And so by strength, the hand of the Lord brought us forth out of Egypt. And so this is what they pass on to every child, and especially in the Passover night, the night to be remembered, the same night, they had the special ceremony, the whole evening, the whole family is there, they had the lamb. Of course, nowadays they can't afford it, so they have just a small part of it. But whatever they have, they recite this whole story of the coming out of Egypt on a personal basis as if they too came out of it. And that was in accordance with the will of God. Now, they have variations, it's okay. God did not necessarily command every tiny little thing. He leaves it to us also, as long as what we do is in accordance with the will of God and spiritually compatible with his teachings. Verse 13, now in verse 17. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God led them not by the way of the land of the Philistines. You see, here it is, the land of the Philistines, that later on, where the Philistines were in the Gaza Strip today, Gaza area, more or less in that area, that's where the Philistines lived, and then later on the Romans took the name of that little strip of land and applied it to the entirety of the land. Why? Because the Philistines were perpetual enemies of the Jews, of King David. Now, you don't want to be in front of King David and call his name, that is his land, that he fought for, and saw the enemies of God all around. You don't want to call it Palestine, you know, to his face. You know, had you lived in his day and called it Palestine, you know, he would have hacked your head off. Of course, that's not necessarily the right thing to do, but that would have been a horrible blasphemy to him, to call the land of God, the land of Israel, the land of the overcomers, by the name of some of the worst enemies of Israel, the Philistines. And that was the intent behind that change of name on the part of the Romans, to infuriate, you know, the Jew, and to call the name of his land by that name. I can just imagine that, you know, if Nazi Germany conquered the United States and they imposed the name of Germany on the United States. Just think about it. How would you feel about it? Well, that's exactly what it is here. That's a blasphemy in the sight of God. And many of us are doing it and listening in our own mind. It's no big deal. Well, it is to God and it is to man, to his servants. And it is to the Jew to this very day. And so God would not lead them through the land of the Philistines, because that's the shortest way and that's the easy way, just along the coast. You know, you go up the coast and you are right by the Mediterranean there. You go into the water and then you wash yourself, you know, easy life. But he said he was not going to do it because God said, lest peradventure the people repent, that is, change their mind about coming out of Egypt, when they see war. You know, they're slaves, they're not used to war, they don't know how to do war. And they see those Philistines coming with their armies. And they had a good army, and all the Israelites would just flee back, you know, into Egypt. And so for that reason, he wouldn't take them through that area. But had they trusted in God with their whole being and heart, which obviously he knew they do not, that would not have been a problem. You know, God would have given them the victory, and, you know, he would have destroyed the Philistines, that wouldn't be a problem. But it's because of the carnality and the rebellious attitude You see, in the faithless spirit, that God didn't do it. And how many times God does not lead us to our destiny the easy way because of that? Because the easy way for us seems to be the hard way. Because we see the big enemy there and we forget. Big enemy, little enemy, doesn't make any difference to God. And because of that, sometimes God takes us on detours before He brings us to our final destiny. Now let's learn, learn a lesson from that too. And we read in verse 18, God says, I'm not going to take them through that land, lest peradventure the people repent when the sea war and they return to Egypt. That's the kind of people they were at that time. And verse 18, but God led the people about, around it, by the way of the wilderness, by the Red Sea, which is harder. Harder road, longer road, dry, wilderness, desert. It's not like, along the coast, you still have green there and palm trees and life is totally different there. But they had to go the hard way. And all of us, unfortunately, we learn our lessons, what? The easy way? No, generally speaking, the hard way. That's the nature that is in us. That God has to purge out of us before we learn to do things the easy way. And the children of Israel went up armed out of the land of Egypt. And they were not totally without weapons. Just, their heart, their mind, their loins were not girded. We're not, fortified with the faith of God. You can have weapons, but if you are scared and fearful, that's not going to do you much good. So they went out armed, and they were armed with all kinds of things, not only weapons, out of the land of Egypt. And later on, God, in essence, made them use it. And He did not deliver them by just destroying the enemy. He made them fight, and they had a war there with Amalek. God could have chosen just to blot them out, and destroy them, and that's it. But He hasn't done that. But, later on, they were still, at that point, when that happened, they were stronger at that point. They were stuck in the wilderness. What else are we going to do? And it happened. So we'll get to that when we get to chapter 17. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straightly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely remember you, and you shall carry up my bones hence with you. And obviously, it was not the bones in the usual sense. It was mummified, probably to this very day, it's still mummified. That's what the Egyptians did it. And so Jacob and Joseph, if you were to dig their graves, probably you'll find a couple of mummies there, and to this very day. And in that manner, they're going to be resurrected. And who knows how many other Israelites were mummified too. And so he says, God will surely remember you, and you shall carry out my bones hence with you. And so the children of Israel had that knowledge. They knew that they are going to be there for a certain number of years. They knew how long passed from Abraham, as we read earlier, about the period of 430 years. And God actually told him 400 years. And as I say, we mentioned that earlier, a lot of people are confused about it, both in the Jewish and non-Jewish community, but the scholars, those who study the law, those who study the words of God more carefully, they see it very plainly for what it really is. And if you just want to go briefly through it, the covenant was given to Abraham when he was 85, and then only at age 100 he had a son, so that's 15 years later. And then his son, Isaac, was 60 before he had children, so he had 15, and 60, that's 75. And then when Jacob, the son of Isaac, who was born when Isaac was 60, when he arrived at Egypt, he was 130 years at that point. And so 205 years already passed from this 400 years, from the days of Abraham. And so what is left there, their stay in Egypt was only 225 years. You see, because they were there actually 430 years. So there were only 225 years in Egypt from the day that Jacob came down there. But you see, the children of Israel continued to live in a prosperity under the old dynasty of the Hyksos. And Levi, the son of Jacob, who came to Egypt, he died at 137, so, and he came around age 50, since Joseph was 39 at the time, and he was older than him. So, he figured out roughly around 50 that he was, and so he lived another 87 years. So for another 87 years, you take that away from the 225, and you end up with roughly around 140 years only But then when he died, it doesn't mean that as soon as he died, because you see, Benjamin was even younger than him. And Benjamin, we don't know exactly how he lived, but if all of them more or less lived, you know, the same age, you know, a few more years before that happened, before all the sons of Israel died, so you end up more roughly with about 100 years of slavery. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people.